Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this special episode of New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm Jason Shulman. Joining me today is John Berger, an award-winning journalist and writer and contributor to Fortune magazine, here to talk about his new book, Datenomics, How Dating Became a Lopsided Numbers Game, published this year by Workman Publishing. John, welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you. John, before we get into what this book has to do with Jewish studies, tell us, what is the man deficit, and what social trends that we're seeing can it help us explain?
Well, the man deficit refers to the shortage of men in what I call the white-collar or college-educated dating pool. So if you go back to the 1980s, women have been graduating from college at a higher rate than men going back to the early 80s and at a much higher rate than men going back to the 90s. So we're now in a situation in the post-college dating world, so to speak, in which we now have 4 college grad women age 30 and under for every 3 college grad men. And obviously this wouldn't be as big an issue if we were all more open-minded about who we dated and married. But the facts and the studies on this show that college grads are increasingly unwilling to date and marry people who have not gone to college. So it's created this lopsidedness in the dating pool.
Mm-hmm. And so the lopsided sex ratios, as you call them, lead to some interesting behavioral patterns. What is that?
Well, in a world in which you have 4 women for every 3 men, it doesn't just make it statistically harder for educated women to find a match, it changes behavior too. And you know, there's been a lot of sociology, psychology, and other scholarly research on sex ratios and their impact on behavior. And the consensus seems to be when women are in oversupply, the whole dating culture becomes more sexualized, women are more likely to be treated as sex objects, and both men and women are slower to embrace monogamy.
Mm-hmm. How have others explained this sexualized phenomena, and why do you find those explanations lacking?
Well, nowadays everybody likes to blame Tinder, and right. To me this is kind of silly because Tinder is 3 years old, and I think if you talk to most young singles in cities like New York or Miami or LA or Chicago, they'll tell you that the hookup culture definitely precedes the launch of Tinder. And in fact, there's a long kind of nonsensical history in the world of blaming the latest new technology for young people having more sex. Back in the 1920s, people liked to blame the automobile, even though there was an obvious demographic explanation for why there was something of a sexual revolution in the 1920s. And that is, you had 10 million young men who died in World War I and another 20 million who were injured, many of them grievously. So back then, similar to today, you had a shortage of men, and that led to a more sexualized dating culture.
Right. So we've talked about the man deficit and some of the outcomes of that. Before we let's get into what this means for Jewish studies. We'll talk about Haredi or ultra-Orthodox Jews in a minute, but I think just sticking with the core of the book, the college campus and the post-college urban experience, I think also pertains to Jews. We know Jews disproportionately attend college and then disproportionately move to big cities with other college-educated people. So the main story of the book seems to be a case of that famous line that's, you know, sometimes attributed to Heinrich Heine or Isaiah Berlin: the Jews are like everybody else, only more so. I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
I think that's pretty accurate. I mean, I'm Jewish, I'm Reform. I know lots of Jewish women in their 30s and 40s who have everything going for them dating-wise, but for whatever reason can't seem to meet a decent guy. And I think, you know, this is a familiar phenomenon to a lot of us, and most of us just explain it away. Maybe they're bad at dating or unlucky at love, or they have the wrong circle of friends. And obviously there's a whole cottage industry of dating books out there that tell women that they're going about this all wrong, that if only they follow these 20 simple or not so simple rules, they'll meet Mr. Right. My argument is that this is not a strategic problem. It's not their fault. It's a demographic problem.
Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about chapter 6, which is entitled Mormons and Jews. This chapter was excerpted in Time Magazine, and I believe you said it's one of your favorite chapters.
It is my favorite chapter.
Okay, good. So what was your original thinking in selecting these two traditional sort of insular groups, and what, in fact, did you end up finding?
Well, initially, I wasn't intending on doing a chapter like this, but as I was writing and researching the more conventional parts of the book, I would have friends and family and other folks who I was talking to about the book come back to me with questions like, well, I hear what you're saying about sex ratios and the hookup culture, but couldn't it just be that times have changed, that values have changed, and that, you know, people there's more permissiveness when it comes to sex. People are less hung up on getting married. That it's just the times have changed, and maybe it's not gender ratios. So what I wanted to explore was whether religious groups with kind of God-fearing, old-fashioned values could be just as susceptible to the effects of lopsided gender ratios as, you know, secular 20-somethings hanging out at wine bars on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. I was doing some research on this, and I came across a study that Trinity College did looking at Mormons. And it turns out that among marriage-age Mormons, there are 3 women for every 2 men. And we can talk about the Mormon research if you'd like as well. But as I was kind of waist deep in Mormon research, I got a call from a hedge fund manager who wanted to talk to me about a job. And I explained to him, well, I'm kind of busy with the book right now. He asked about the book. I told him about the Mormon marriage crisis. And his response was, huh, that sounds a lot like the Shaddock crisis. And I'm Jewish, but obviously not Jewish enough because I had never heard of the Shaddock crisis. But as I learned, it's a marriage crisis that is oddly similar to what's going on in Utah.
Right. So tell us very briefly, what is the story of the man deficit in the Mormon community? And then tell us why the Shaddock crisis boils down to a math problem.
Okay. So in the Mormon world, women tend to be more devout. But usually it's just, it's by a small percentage point or two. I think throughout most religious groups, about 52% of members are women versus 48% male. So men do have a slight tendency to leave churches or organized religion. However, it's more extreme in the Mormon world. It's closer to 60% among people under age 40. 60% of the Mormon church or the LDS church is female. And that's because of the increased importance of the Mormon mission in LDS life. As you probably know, young Mormons, particularly young Mormon men, tend to do 2-year missions that's kind of a mix of proselytizing and community service. And it used to be that going on a mission was essentially voluntary, but as the LDS church has been pushing all able-bodied men to go on missions, this has created kind of an issue. And missions are very expensive. The missions and their families pay for them themselves. Some families can't afford the cost. It also some young men don't want to delay going to college or delay getting into the workforce by 2 years. So they pass on taking a mission. And what happens is because doing a Mormon mission has become a prerequisite for leadership within the Mormon church, there's kind of a social stigma against not having gone on a mission. And this seems to be pushing some young men out of the church. And as a result, you have this marriage market among Mormons in which the men have all the leverage because a material number of young men left the church, and this has left this 3-to-2 ratio among marriage age Mormons.
You know, John, there was an article in the journal Jewish Political Studies Review in 2008 that sort of reminded me of the Mormon story, and sort of what you were saying at the beginning. You know, in general, religions tend to be, females tend to be more devout in across religions. But this article found that in the liberal wings of Judaism, Jewish boys and men were being more so alienated from synagogue life, which had, this review found, the auxiliary effect of increasing the likelihood that they will marry non-Jewish women. So before we get into the ultra-Orthodox community, I wanted to add that there is sort of a parallel here among Jewish men just sort of leaving the fold, right?
I think so, although it really is all religion. The women just tend to be more devout, and I think there's a particular age in which men are most likely to leave the fold, and I think that's essentially late teens, early 20s, and I suspect that those young men are leaving Reformed or conservative synagogues or congregations around that age frame. Am I right that that's when this was occurring?
I'm not sure, but that seems reasonable.
Yeah. So I'm not arguing with the idea that synagogues and churches as well could be doing things differently to better retain Jewish men, but I think it's a fairly universal phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about the ultra-Orthodox community, because there the problem is not men leaving the community, it's actually a math problem. So tell us what's going on.
It's a math problem. So among a certain segment of the ultra-Orthodox community, the Lithuanian or Yeshivish Orthodox, all Orthodox have a very high birth rate, as you know. According to one of the demographers I interviewed, I think the average Orthodox family has 4 children versus 2 children, which I think is the U.S. average. And I have to admit, 4 sounds low to me because I just know so many Orthodox families who have 5, 6, 7 kids. But let's just say it's 4. The way the math works is that every 1-year age cohort within the Orthodox community will have 4% more members than the one that preceded it. So there'll be 4% more 18-year-olds than 19-year-olds, 4% more 19-year-olds than 20-year-olds, and so on and so on. From a marriage perspective and a dating perspective, this wouldn't matter if 18-year-olds were marrying other 18-year-olds or 19-year-olds were marrying other 19-year-olds. But in the yeshivish Orthodox world, what happens is the girls or the young women tend to get married at 18, whereas the young men do 3 or 4, sometimes 5 years in a yeshiva and then maybe another year studying in Israel, and they don't marry until they're 22 or 23. So this age gap at marriage creates an excess supply of young women because, given the birth rate, there are always going to be more 18-year-olds than 22-year-olds, and therefore they're going to be more 18-year-old women than 22-year-old men. So that's the math problem.
Mm-hmm. And so the Shidduch crisis has received a lot of attention. There was an article in the New Republic in February that was called "Ultra-Orthodox Jews Are Panicking Over Their Matchmaking Crisis." What kind of things did you hear in your research about people panicking about this?
Well, it's tough for both ultra-Orthodox and for Mormons as well, because in the secular world, a single person obviously can lead a fulfilled, happy life without ever getting married. But I think in some of these very ultra-religious communities, and this covers both Mormons and ultra-Orthodox Jews, so much of women's identity and role in the community is defined by marriage and motherhood, that it becomes really hard on these single women. And there's this intense pressure put on very young women, actually sometimes teenage girls, to physically appear as marriageable as possible, you know, as young as 16 or 17. And you would hear these stories of 16 or 17 year old girls who maybe they, you know, they're a size 8 dress size, and they have people telling them if they don't lose weight, they'll never find a husband.
Right. The Sisterhood, which is a blog of the Forward, had an article in early September criticizing the Schittel crisis for leading to an orthodox obsession with female beauty. Who is Yitta Halberstam, and why did she provoke such a reaction in 2012?
Well, she's a Jewish author. I should probably disclose that that she's not a fan of me at this point. but she wrote a column in the Jewish press a few years ago. Her own son was going through the matchmaking process, and she felt bad about how many options he had and how few options his female peers had. But in the telling of this, she recounted a story of going to a community event where parents of young men would meet prospective matches, young women. And she was struck by how unattractive so many of the women were. And she said they weren't wearing makeup. And then she went so far as to suggest that some of them undergo plastic surgery in order to appear more attractive. And, you know, to me, I mean, she emailed me and she argued that she was well-meaning in this and she just wants to help young women. But to me, this is emblematic of a sickness, that this notion that 16 and 17-year-old girls or 18-year-old young women should feel pressure to change their bodies, to have nose jobs, to lose a few pounds in order to appear marriageable. I think it's incredibly unhealthy. And that was my reaction to her column. Certainly others, when it came out a few years ago, had the same reaction.
Mm-hmm. You know, there is a scholarship by cultural historian and historian of medicine Stanard Gilman, who has written about Jewish nose jobs. And he says that nose jobs show us the desire for invisibility, the desire to look like everyone else, that has shaped how Jews have altered their bodies, both men and women. So what notion of beauty do you think these Jewish mothers who are concerned think that Jewish men want?
I'm not sure, but you know, when I think about the Jewish nose jobs, I can't help but trying to picture what the reaction would be if a African American leader suggested that young African American women get their broad noses redone or undergo skin lightening or hair straightening in order to improve their own marriage prospects. I think rightly there would be an enormous uproar over this. And Yitta Halberstam told me that after she wrote her column, there was a doctor in Miami who offered to do nose jobs for some of these women. And as it turns out, after the surgery, several of these women found husbands. And this was her justification, her explanation. I mean, to me, the mere fact that some of them got married after they got nose jobs certainly does not justify the horrible message this sends to young women.
Are there any religious changes going on because of the man deficit? I got the sense that, you know, women and their families know that they need to be on their best behavior to attract the very few men that are available. So there's a lot more strict conformity. excuse me. There's a lot more sense that you're being observed and judged. Did you get any sense of that?
Well, I mean, are you familiar with these resumes that young women are expected to provide to their male?
For better or worse, I am not.
You're not. Okay. So the women who are going through the matchmaking process are expected to fill out these resumes that are then reviewed by men. And I assume early on, a lot of it was more mundane stuff about where you grew up and where you got a synagogue and who your parents were and that kind of thing. But a standard part of these resumes, and these resumes are frequently distributed by matchmakers who I think work with synagogues. But on these resumes, these young women are not only expected to disclose their own dress size, but the dress sizes of their mothers. So these young men can project what their wife-to-be might look like after she has four kids. To me, this is a sickness that people in that community need to sort of come to their senses and realize that this kind of pressure on young women, not only is it unhealthy, it certainly doesn't conform with Jewish values.
Mm-hmm. So let's think about two approaches to this. First, what if the crisis is largely exaggerated and, you know, yes, there are some women who are not getting married, but not more so than in other contexts or in history. Why are some people inclined to make the crisis seem worse than it is? That's approach number one. And approach number two is, let's say the crisis really is as bad as everyone says it is. What are the ramifications for the community?
Well, it's only most people in the community do get married. So I think statistically, it's not a crisis for the majority of ultra-Orthodox Jews. It's a crisis for the young women and their families. It shouldn't be a crisis because, like I said, there's no reason why a man or a woman shouldn't be able to lead a fulfilled life, a happy life, a productive life without being married. But as you know, in that community, marriage and parenting and parenthood are not lifestyle choices, or are not really lifestyle choices. They're kind of an expectation built into the system.
You say that you have sort of a control group among ultra-Orthodox Jews. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So Hasidic Jews culturally are similar, and they certainly have a similarly high birth rate. And Hasidic Jews also use matchmakers to pair their young women and men for marriage. But what makes Hasidic Jews different is that the boys generally don't spend as much time in yeshiva, and they get married at age 18 or 19 at the same age that the girls get married. So you don't have this age gap at marriage in the Hasidic community. And there's, as a result, if you talk to either Hasidic Jews or academics like Samuel Heilman, who study the Hasidic community, they'll tell you that Hasidic Jews don't really understand what the Shidduch crisis is all about. So to me, the fact that there is no Shidduch crisis in the Hasidic community, and also some of the yeshivish rabbis have realized this and are now suggesting that the young men begin the matchmaking process earlier, I think this shows that this is largely a demographic problem. It's not a cultural one.
Mm-hmm. I want to read you something and get your reaction. I asked Carmel Chiswick, who's one of the foremost experts on how economics shape Jewish practice, to read your excerpt in Time. And she said that on the difference between the yeshivish and the Hasidic communities, there is research to show that when the purpose of marriage is procreation, so having lots of children, men want to marry younger women. And so that you'll find that, on average, there's an age difference between spouses, and that'll be a good predictor of the average family size in the community. For most American Jews, the purpose is companionship, and so economic analysis will predict that you'll actually find people with very similar ages getting married. So the difference in marriage patterns between the yeshivish, which has sort of large range, age range, and the Hasidic, who sort of marry people their own age, may suggest a difference in how these two groups understand the very purpose of marriage. Did you hear anything like that?
I didn't, and I think in the yeshivish world, it didn't used to be this way. I don't think there was as much pressure on the young men to spend years and years in yeshiva. And I think, 50 years ago in this community, the young men were not delaying marriage in the same way. But nowadays, this is an exaggeration, but there's a little bit of a everybody becomes a rabbi mentality in that world, in which all the young men are expected to spend years and years studying Torah and Talmud, that I think that is why there's more of an age gap now than there used to be.
Mm-hmm. Okay, John, we are running out of time. So let's talk a little bit about some of the solutions that you propose, both for the overall crisis and specifically for the Jewish community.
Well, for the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, I do have a suggestion, and I'm not at all a religious scholar, so I have no idea whether this would pass muster. But to me, it's wrong to blame the matchmakers for this problem. These are hardworking people, usually women who are trying their best. But they're fighting against a system that's incredibly difficult. To me, it would be an act of kindness, an act of compassion, if the rabbis in the ultra-Orthodox community would agree not to marry women age 21 or younger. Because not only would this reduce the pressure on teenage girls to appear as marriageable as possible, it would also improve the marriage prospects of some of these mid-20s or late-20s, quote-unquote, older girls who do feel like they're in crisis and seem unable to find their match. So to me, the solution has to start with the rabbis, and my suggestion would be agree not to marry 18, 19-year-old young women, to encourage them to delay marriage till 21 or 22.
Mm-hmm. And in your book, you do mention maybe not a romantic notion, but there have been some monetary plans put in place.
Yeah, so are you talking about the dowries or about the Shaddock initiative that was there was one group that came up with the idea of creating an economic incentive for matchmakers to pair marriageable men with women either their own age or older. I don't think this got real far, in part because people found it a little bit degrading, because the size of the payments to the matchmakers went up with the age of the woman. I think from an economic standpoint, I understand the logic, but when you're talking about real people, it's kind of unpleasant.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, we've taken up a lot of your time. So any parting thoughts you'd like to share, and what are you working on next?
I'm still working on my next book idea. I'm not sure if it'll have anything to do with marriage. I guess my parting thoughts involving secular dating. If there is an oversupply of women in the college educated dating pool, there's going to be an oversupply of men in the working class dating pool. And in fact, that's the reality. And my belief is that in coming years, we'll see an increase in what I call mixed collar marriages, which are pairings of educated career women and working class guys. And in fact, just the other day, I got a tweet from a woman who told me that she met her husband after she unchecked education on her online dating site.
John, I want to thank you for being on the show today. The book is Datanomics: How Dating Became a Lopsided Numbers Game. The author is John Berger. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thank you for joining us. Check us out at newbooksinjewishstudies.com. You can download the podcast on iTunes, check out our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter at New Books Judaism. Got an idea for a book we should cover? Send us an email, newbooksinjewishstudies@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.